this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the cover story headline, Watering a Fruitless Tree. Local universities struggle to turn research into commercial success. And that's the headline on the front page. The article begins inside the Triangle Business Journal with another headline. Falling behind in tech transfer. While UNC, Duke, and NC State have distinguishable strengths, latest tech transfer activity shows tepid results for all three colleges. And this article is written by Jason DeBruin. In 2011, Scott Boland left a short career as a high school English teacher to earn an MBA from NC State University. While in the Poole College of Management's entrepreneurship program, he was introduced to forestry professors Joel Pawlik and Richard Venditti, who had developed a new kind of moisture-absorbing chemical but were running out of federal grant money. Fresh off classes, Boland saw an opportunity. He co-founded Tethys and licensed the invention from NC State. Tethys has now raised $3 million in private investments and is on the cusp of generating revenue. NC State could benefit as well. Depending on the Tethys product, the university could receive a sales royalty. Agreements like this are commonplace across higher education. In the 2013 to 2014 school year alone, universities executed nearly 6,900 licenses or options with industry. For the Triangle, NC State, Duke University, and UNC Chapel Hill did not play a prominent role in that kind of activity. That's despite the universities lassoing billions of dollars in research funding from state and federal governments. A mediocre licensing report card meant not only less revenue coming back to the academic institutions, but far less higher education-driven entrepreneurial activity in the Triangle. From 2012 through 2014, UNC recorded $13.7 million and NCSU recorded $20.6 million in cumulative adjusted gross income, a middle-of-the-pack performance by institutions that often are among the elite schools in several other categories. Across the nation, 68 of 191 universities that responded to an annual licensing survey recorded at least $14 million in gross income during that time, and 54 universities recorded at least $21 million. Duke University recorded $88 million in that same time frame, a figure bested by 20 universities around the country. All data come from the Association of University Technology Managers, or AUTM, the national organization that tracks the performance of startup and licensing activity from universities based on responses to the survey. By another measure tracked by AUTM, Duke spun out 6 startups in 2014 compared to 10 each for UNC and NCSU. Those figures also lag when compared to startup activity from peer universities around the nation. 31 universities spun out at least 10 companies, and 54 universities spun out 6 or more companies. Purdue University, for example, launched 24 startups that year. Our universities are among the best in the nation at attracting research dollars, and yet our licensing and innovation on the back end does not equate, says Laura Shope, founder and president of Funtech, which provides intellectual property management consulting services. In essence, universities are seen as economic engines, but when it comes to launching entrepreneurs or licensing next-generation technologies, the Triangle's Big Three don't perform as well as universities they benchmark themselves against. Far below peer groups. The licensing, royalty, and spin-out numbers across most universities in the U.S. are growing rapidly. In 2014 alone, the number of licenses executed that included equity acquired by the research institution hit 549, a 17% increase from the previous year. Many pharmaceuticals on the market today grew out of early-stage chemistry or biology that started in a university. Northwestern University received $361 million from licensing income in 2014 alone, nearly entirely because of the success of Lyrica, a Pfizer drug that can trace its roots to the Illinois University. Professors at the University of Florida famously developed Gatorade, nicknamed after the university's mascot, which helped propel it to one of the most highly regarded tech transfer universities in the nation. Canines bred at Auburn University have developed a unique ability to detect and track mobile explosives, such as bombs being carried through airports or crowded urban settings. For the Triangle Universities, however, numbers show the success stories are too few and far between, and the Raleigh-Durham area's Big Three are falling behind its peer groups. Among 13 peers, not including those in California and Texas, which report statistics for the combined system, not individual state universities, UNC ranks ninth when measuring the cumulative licensing income from 2012 through 2014, and 12th when measuring total invention disclosures over the same period. NCSU ranks better compared to its peers, even coming in second by a measure of licenses and options executed in 2014. By other measures, however, it ranks closer to the median. Kelly Sexton, director of the NCSU Office of Technology Transfer, says NCSU intentionally sets its sights high when choosing peers. "I think we've picked a strong group of really aspirational peers," she says. "My view is that we are doing quite well." Judith Cohn, UNC Chapel Hill's interim vice chancellor of commercialization and economic development, says UNC research has contributed to the betterment of society, sometimes in ways that don't appear in the numbers tracked by AUTM. She points specifically to HIV work that has helped prevent the spread of AIDS and concussion research that made advances in the diagnosis, treatment, and prevention of sports-related concussions, including by UNC sports medicine professor Kevin Guskowitz, who was named a MacArthur Foundation Fellow for his work. Other universities, of course, do this kind of research as well. Northwestern Global Health Foundation also works to prevent HIV, and its benefit is not captured neatly in the AUTM data either. Yet Alicia Loeffler, Associate Vice President of Research at Northwestern, calls it the organization that I am actually most proud of at Northwestern. Loeffler concedes that hitting a home run like Lyrica helps in that revenue will decline sharply in the coming years as Lyrica rolls off patent protection. "We hit the lottery," she says. Northwestern recorded $740 million in 2012 to 2014 cumulative adjusted gross income, the most in the nation in that period. UNC is still waiting for that home run. Winning is in the commercialization area is as much luck as well as a well-run support organization as well as good research, says Cohn. Happenstance does play a role, he says. A better country. Almost 40 years ago, lawmakers in Washington, D.C. finally figured out the formula for entrepreneurial success. As a result, in addition to providing post-secondary education, universities were charged with performing groundbreaking research to advance science and human well-being. The United States federal government has placed a high value on this research, pumping some $40 billion in taxpayer dollars each year into universities to perform groundbreaking research. The ability for universities to patent and commercialize federally funded inventions became possible in 1980 with the passage of the Bayh-Dole Act. At the time, federal agencies held 28,000 patents, but less than 5% of those had been licensed, according to a report from the Federal Government Accountability Office. By allowing universities to retain ownership of the inventions their researchers made with federal dollars, the hope was that it would spur the economy. By many accounts, the results have been successful. Staying optimistic. Looking ahead, there is reason to believe entrepreneurship might increase locally. The AUTM data lags, and NCSU's Sexton says spin-out activity has been higher in the past 2 years. In 2010, UNC began putting more emphasis on innovation that could ultimately lead to more entrepreneurial activity down the road. In addition, recently formed Triangle Venture Alliance, or TVA, a partnership of Duke, UNC, NCSU, and NC Central University, will look to build an alumni network to invest in new ventures. It will coordinate a network of angel groups that tap into the alumni base of each university in an effort to bring seed capital to the Triangle. In addition, UNC recently launched Carolina Research Ventures, a $10 million fund managed by Durham-based Hatteras Venture Partners that will invest in UNC spinouts. UNC's Cohn argues that spinning startups out of UNC presents more challenges because the university doesn't have an engineering school, which can spin technology into companies that require less initial capital than drug development companies. Politics, policy, and porcelain dish. In other ways, however, industry experts fear recent legislative actions, particularly House Bill 2, will retard or even reverse gains made from a legislative innovation to jobs initiative aimed at increasing entrepreneurial activity. Funtech Shope sat on the University Innovation Council, tasked with improving entrepreneurial ecosystem in the state, but says, "Unfortunately, HB 2 torpedoed those efforts," and resigned from the committee. On NCSU's Centennial campus, the focus is away from Jones Street, however. Stephen First hammers away on a smart material technology that could one day improve solar panels, home windows, and laptop screens. If his company, Smart Material Solutions, succeeds, NCSU wins too. First licensed the technology that underpins his company from the university, and if the company succeeds in producing a commercially viable product, the university will receive downstream royalty revenue. So far, his funding has mostly come through grants from the Small Business Technology Transfer, or STTR, office, the sister program of the more widely known Small Business Innovation Research, SBIR, grant. First hopes to receive a Phase 2 grant that would be in the $750,000 range. To First, a runner who has competed in Olympic trials and turned in performances in as little as 13 minutes and 29 seconds, the NCSU Tech Transfer Office has been of service to him. "Certainly that was my experience," he says. "I've spoken to a number of other companies, and many of them complain about their tech transfer offices, but NC State is really good." And now we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle Happenings, written by digital producer Mark DeRoberts. The main headline, with Rutherford as GM, Raleigh shows ample love. Raleigh-Durham hockey fans are so starved for playoff hockey that they flock to their television sets, even if the final pitted the Pittsburgh Penguins against the San Jose Sharks. Of course, for local hockey fans, Biz thinks much had to do with the Penguins general manager, Jim Rutherford. The 67-year-old executive who was at the helm of the Carolina Hurricanes for 20 years before leaving for Pittsburgh in 2014. "Keep believing in whatever you do," Rutherford told the crowd during the team's championship parade on June 15, referring to the Penguins' slow start to the season and how the team upped its game during the latter half of the season. "And we will try to be here next year," Rutherford panned to a cheering crowd. The Triangle market tied for eighth with a rating of 3.6 among television markets, tracked by the Nielsen Company. The top two make sense, and the others in the top ten follow suit, with the only head-scratcher being West Palm Beach. With 4 million viewers, the 2016 Stanley Cup Final was the highest-rated final since 2001 that didn't include an original six team, and viewership was up 31% compared with the 2012 final, the last final to not include an original 16. Here are the list of the top 10 markets. Number 1, Pittsburgh, rating of 31.7. 2, San Francisco, Oakland, San Jose, 7.0. Buffalo, 5.8 rating. Minneapolis, St. Paul, 4.2. Denver, 4.1. West Palm Beach, Florida, 3.9, Boston, 3.7, Raleigh-Durham, 3.6, Sacramento, 3.6, and St. Louis, 3.6. Old Chatham Club introduces new golf league for local juniors. Old Chatham Golf Club has formed its first ever PGA Junior League team. The team will have 11 players aged 8 to 13 years old and compete in a league of 5 triangle-based teams. For each match, at least 2 teammates compete against a similar grouping from an opposing team on 9 holes in a scramble match play format. The 2016 regular season runs through July 31, with postseason qualifiers beginning in August and the regional championship starting in September. Burger Berry shine as TCA gets boost. 1 month after the WHO legend Roger Daltrey's visit to Raleigh to promote his Teen Cancer America TCA charity, comes some more good news for the nonprofit, which has some strong triangle ties. TCA ambassador and PGA golfer Daniel Berger won his first title on the tour on June 12, FedEx St. Jude Classic, with Cary resident Grant Berry as his caddy. To win the St. Jude Classic, an event benefiting St. Jude Children's Research Hospital and their efforts to fight childhood cancer, while also bringing national attention to TCA, is a great feeling, Berger said the day after winning the tourney. Since launching in the U.S. in 2012, TCA has projects underway or in development with world-class cancer centers at UCLA, Stanford, Memorial Sloan Kettering, New York, Dana-Farber, Harvard, Yale, University of Chicago, Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, Moffitt, Tampa, Vanderbilt University, Baylor University, and Case University. Sources: Food Truck Contest Winners Plan Eatery. Looks like the famous duo Sunny Lin and Sophia Wu of food truck Phenomenal Dumpling Truck may have a brick-and-mortar establishment in Raleigh in the works. Biz has heard that the owners of the food truck that won the Food Network's The Great Food Truck Race last year is eyeing a site across from Meredith College on Hillsborough Street. So when Biz called Wu to talk more about the latest development, Wu simply said, "I cannot say anything at this point. There's nothing concrete yet." Inside the deal, Gillings, Center of Exec Negotiations. From the outset, any deal between Quintiles and IMS Health was not moving forward unless IMS CEO Ari Boosbib led the combined company. The companies announced a massive merger in May, but more documents about the merger recently became available. In a February meeting that included Quintiles founder Dennis Gillings, IMS Health board members said they were interested in a merger, but had a strong interest in Boosbib leading the combined company, not Quintile CEO Tom Pike. Gillings took that demand back to the full Quintiles board, which ultimately agreed, provided that Pike keeps a senior management position. Despite not leading the combined company, Pike will still be handsomely compensated if he stays on. If he stays through December 31, 2017, he will receive $10 million in salary and bonuses, as well as $7 million in stock awards. Dominion's Andrews says building for sale as planned. Well, it did not take long for Dominion Realty Partners Andy Andrews to test the commercial building sales market in the Triangle. Little more than a year after Andrews opened the 11-story Charter Square building in downtown Raleigh, he is putting it up for sale. "This was part of our plan right from the start," Andrews tells Biz. He goes on to explain that the equity financing for the $63 million building project came primarily from a real estate growth fund managed by Prudential Real Estate Investors. Under terms of the deal, any equity and potential profits in the property would be cashed out at around the one-year anniversary. Let the bidding begin. And now we turn to the On Real Estate page written by Amanda Hoyle. The main headline: four new office building projects on the books. Commercial real estate developers and their investors are becoming more bullish about the Triangle's Class A office market, as demand over the past few quarters has been outpacing the construction of new buildings and pushed the average vacancy rate to its lowest level in 15 years. But it was still surprising when four different real estate development groups in the span of less than a week announced plans for four new office building projects, much of which could move forward speculatively with no pre-lease commitments. All total, the projects could add another 506,000 square feet of new urban and suburban office space over the next 2 years if all plans stay on schedule and each developer is able to secure the necessary debt and equity financing. 1. Regency Woods 2 on Symphony Lake is slated to be a five-story, 150,000-square-foot office building at Regency Park in Cary that will overlook Symphony Lake and the Cocoa Booth Amphitheater. Spectrum Properties' J.D. McNeil says construction could begin by fall or winter of 2016, with the building ready for tenant move-ins in fall 2018. The nearly $30 million building would be constructed on a 17-acre site already owned by Spectrum Properties. The site is next to the 125,000-square-foot Regency Woods 1 office building that's 100% leased to HCL Technologies. 2645 Meridian Parkway is slated to be a three-story, 76,446-square-foot office building in Durham. About 75% of the building has already been pre-leased under a long-term contract with Durham-based MedL, a global hearing implant manufacturer, which will be occupying 57,000 square feet in the new building. Virginia-based American Real Estate Partners is financing the $19 million project after a recent acquisition of the parcel at Meridian Corporate Park. It will be the first new construction at Meridian in nearly 16 years. CBRE Raleigh will be handling the leasing of the remaining office space. The station at East 54 is slated to be a six-story building on NC 54 in Chapel Hill, adjacent to the established East 54 mixed-use community with a loft hotel. The $20 million building project will include a two-level parking deck and about 55,000 square feet of office space on the upper four floors. The project will also include the demolition of the current city fire station number 2 and the construction of a new fire station at the site. Bryson Powell, a partner in the project with East West Partners, says he has no pre-lease commitments for the office building signed yet, but interest is already high. Construction is expected to be underway by January 2017 with about a 12-month build-out. And One Glenwood is slated to be a 10-story, 224,500-square-foot office and retail building at the intersection of Glenwood Avenue and Hillsborough Street, one of the highest elevations in downtown Raleigh. The $75 million building project will also have 15,000 square feet of retail space, a roof terrace, sky lounge, and fitness center. It is being developed and financed by Baltimore-based Heritage Properties. Trinity Partners of Raleigh will be handling the pre-leasing for the new building. Home sales activity sizzles in May. With home mortgage rates at near three-year lows, home buyers in the Triangle came out at near record spring levels in May, pushing the sales volume up nearly 11% going into the traditional high-selling summer sales months. A Triangle Multiple Listing Service report shows that buyers closed on the purchase of 3,733 new and existing homes in the Triangle region in May, which was 20% more homes sold than was recorded in April. The Triangle's total inventory of available homes for sale remained at a low 2.9-month supply in May. A 6-month inventory of homes is considered normal. Echelon closes Fair Restaurant at Cameron Village. The Fair Steak and Seafood Restaurant next to Cameron Village in Raleigh served its last dinner guests on June 12, and the restaurant's ownership group confirms it won't be reopening for business. According to a representative from Fair's ownership group at Echelon Experiences, the restaurant's business had become unsustainable inside the Berkshire Cameron Village apartment building at the corner of Oberlin Road and Clark Avenue. There had been a lot of issues since it opened, from delayed construction of the building to crummy parking and a lot of other things, so we had to make the tough decision that it couldn't stay open, says Tara Zecchini, marketing director of Echelon Experiences. Fair had opened in October 2014, shortly after the building was completed. New Aloft Hotel opens near RDU International Airport. The Triangle Area's fourth Aloft-branded hotel is open for business near Briar Creek and Raleigh-Durham International Airport. The new hotel at 10020 Salona Street in Raleigh, which is about 4 miles from RDU, has 144 guest rooms, about 2,000 square feet of meeting space, a fitness center, and a grab-and-go food and beverage area. The hotel is owned and managed by Huntersville-based Narcee Properties. The Starwood Hotels owned Aloft brand also has properties in Chapel Hill, downtown Raleigh, and downtown Durham. And now we turn to the On Pharmaceuticals page, written by Jason DeBruin. The main headline, Unplugged, Salix's kickback scheme, settlement with Fed reveals plan. Salix Pharmaceuticals, the Raleigh drug company acquired by Valiant Pharmaceuticals International in 2015, used speaker programs as a vehicle to pay kickbacks to doctors, according to details of a federal investigation unsealed by a federal court. Details became available after Valiant settled for $54 million, a federal investigation that stemmed from a whistleblower lawsuit. As part of the settlement, Salix made extensive admissions regarding its conduct, according to the federal government. Through these speaker programs, which were frequently nothing more than social gatherings with little or no educational component, Salix found a way to pay doctors money and treated them to fancy meals to push their drugs, said Manhattan U.S. Attorney Preet Bharara. McEldrew Young represented the initial whistleblower in the lawsuit. Salix had been accused of, among other things, gathering at high-end restaurants with little or no time discussing Salix drugs, doctors attending multiple programs on the same topic over a short period of time, pre-recorded presentations that were not played or were not in a location conducive to watching or listening, and gatherings including non-healthcare professionals such as physician spouses. Drug and medical device companies have paid billions of dollars to doctors as speakers, researchers, and consultants, said Eric Young, partner with McEldrew Young. Salix crossed the line and those payments became kickbacks when its speaker program stopped focusing on education and instead rewarded doctors for writing prescriptions. FastMed links with TouchCare to forward mobile doctor visits. FastMed Urgent Care will use technology developed by Durham mobile health startup TouchCare to offer a feature by which patients can conduct a doctor visit over smartphone or tablet. Telemedicine, the delivery of healthcare through telecommunications, has been a growing healthcare trend in recent years, even in emergency medicine, through local companies like RelyMD, which was launched by Wake Emergency Physicians last year with some early success. The TouchCare app connects patients with their providers, but will now allow users to connect to an urgent care physician with FastMed as well. Financial details were not disclosed. And in a section called He Said It, the quote, Operator, next question. That's from Joseph Papa, Valiant Pharmaceuticals International CEO, in dodging a question during a conference call with analysts related to Adiye, the female libido drug it acquired with Raleigh-based Sprout Pharmaceuticals. Sprout investors have complained about Valiant's handling of the Adiye launch. And in a section called Big Numbers, $1.25 billion. What drug giant Merck could end up paying for California drug developer Afferent Pharmaceuticals, depending on milestones, Durham Life Sciences Investment Group Papa's Ventures was an investor of Afferent. And 3% to 40% potential increase in pay for Triangle Area mental health providers next year, after Alliance Behavioral Healthcare announced another strong operating year. And in a section called Drug Trials, Argos receives good news from Review Board. An independent review board has recommended the continuation of a late-stage trial testing of cancer treatment developed by Durham-based Argos Therapeutics. Detailed during trials testing experimental drugs, developers receive little and only intermittent results from the trial in order to prevent undue influence. Independent Data Monitoring Committees, IDMC, monitor safety results to protect patients if early indications show a drug is not safe for patients in order to halt a trial if necessary. The IDMC recommended the continuation of the trial, indicating the experimental Argos drug is safe. The positive outcome from the IDMC also triggers a second tranche of financing to Argos. The drug developer will sell shares worth $30 million as part of a previously negotiated deal that could ultimately be worth up to $60 million in additional capital. And now we turn to the On Tech and Transportation page written by Lauren Onasorge. The first headline, CloudGenix picks Raleigh for ops. CloudGenix, a Silicon Valley software startup with $34 million in venture financing, has tapped Raleigh for an expansion. Raleigh site lead Matthew Phillips, an EMC veteran, compares the company to a rocket ship. Glenwood South was picked to lead that growth on the East Coast. Already there's a staff of about 10. He expects that local headcount to increase to about 20 in the coming weeks. Phillips says the talent in the Triangle attracted the company to Raleigh, as did the low cost of living. We have a beautiful headquarters campus in San Jose that could easily house all of these job functions, he says, explaining that the cost of living is astronomical. However, it makes it very, very hard to find talent that can afford to live there and is also entry level. Specifically, he says a good fit might be an employee at a company like Citrix or Red Hat who feels like a drop in the ocean and wants to stand out. This is a rocket ship, he says. We're 100 employees today, but we're going to explode. We're going to take over this industry in the shortest time I've ever seen a startup do it. It's going to be a great ride. CloudGenix works in what's called software-defined wide-area networks. It's about better connecting branch offices, data centers, and other corporate facilities over large geographic distances. SD-WAN has less than a 1% market share today, according to recent Gartner estimates. But Gartner predicts that 30% of users will be using software to manage their WAN within the next 3 years. OneJet CEO, RDU on shortlist for service. An upstart carrier that recently announced it was adding Louisville and Cincinnati to its network confirms Raleigh-Durham International Airport is on its shortlist. Business-focused flyer OneJet, the result of an MIT collaboration with transportation officials, had its debut flights just last year. Unlike other small aircraft services, it operates from normal passenger terminals and gates, built to be a one-stop option in areas where multiple connections are usually required to get to your final destination. CEO Matthew McGuire says he has been eyeing the Triangle market for some time. When we look at the market, we want to see good regional travel and also a strong business base, he said. I think Raleigh certainly fits those descriptions. Specifically, Raleigh is on the short list for what he calls focus city status, where OneJet bases an airplane and a crew, because really, we think the market can support that. He couldn't offer a time frame, but does say operations at OneJet are about to pick up steam. Right now, the fleet consists of 3 7-seat jets. By September, OneJet will be up to 6 planes. Raleigh IT services firm adds 40% more space. Raleigh IT management firm Carolinas IT is expanding. According to a site plan filed with the city, Carolinas IT plans to add about 4,000 square feet of space to its current building, bringing its footprint to about 10,500 square feet on Hillsborough Street. The second floor of the current structure will extend over a parking lot, creating more collaborative office space and covered parking. CEO Mark Cavallaro says the expansion design included input from the firm's 63 employees and includes renovations of the break room and bathrooms. And in the section called She Said It, the quote, "You have to be able to reinvent yourself and reskill yourself if you're going to be successful going forward." And that's from Fran O'Sullivan, site lead for IBM in RTP. And in a section called By the Numbers, $5.8 million. The amount that Texas app marketing firm Digital Turbine reported it lost in its fourth quarter earnings, failing to meet Wall Street expectations. The company acquired Durham app marketer Appia in March 2015. The unit that includes the Appia business came in at $15 million, making up 65% of the total revenue in the fourth quarter. Digital Turbine reported a total of $23 million in revenue. For the year, that total was $86.5 million, with the loss widening to $28 million. And in general news, we have a headline, NC GDP growth rate outpaces nation, this article written by Jason DeBruin. After two quarters of high growth, North Carolina's gross domestic product growth rate slowed in the fourth quarter of 2015. While growth was still higher than the national average, North Carolina fell below the Southeast average for the first time since the second quarter of 2014. North Carolina's GDP grew at a rate of 1.8% in the fourth quarter, according to figures released by the Federal Bureau of Economic Analysis. That growth rate ranks 20th in the nation and 6th among the 12 southeastern states. Taken as a whole, the states in the southeast recorded a 2.1% growth. Michael Walden, an NC State University economist, took a national view as a positive that North Carolina outpaced national average growth. In the first eight quarters of 2014 and 2015, the U.S. average growth outpaced North Carolina's quarterly growth just twice. The GDP report was consistent with the state's more rapid job growth during 2015 and suggests NC has once again reclaimed its position as one of the fastest-growing states in the nation, Walden wrote in an email. This is typical of our pattern during business cycles. NC tends to be hit harder during recessions, but generally does better during economic expansions. And now we turn to A Better World, written by Todd Cohen, who also publishes Philanthropy North Carolina, and the headline on his column, Mission to Feed and Reading to Kids. On different evenings once a week during the school year, a total of 500 children, ages 5 to 11, who are students in Wake County Public Schools, spend an hour or more enjoying a meal and then listening to stories, reading aloud, and getting three books to take home and keep for personal libraries they are building. The after-school literacy program, which serves another 100 kids during the summer, takes place either in one of three mobile classrooms, or in schools or at community centers or nonprofits. Providing the after-school literacy program is Read and Feed, a Cary nonprofit that has served over 650 children since it was formed in 2007. Being able to read at grade level is a predictor of success and high school graduation, says Katie Mullen, executive director of Read and Feed. If you can read, you can do anything. The nonprofit works to provide easy access to reading programs for at-risk, low-income children who typically are reading at least one grade level below their grade in school. But the reality is they're often further behind, says Mullen. Operating with an annual budget of $400,000 and a staff of two people working full-time and one working part-time, Read and Feed accounts on 425 active volunteers who provide a total of over 7,700 hours a year of service. Volunteers handle tasks that range from tutoring, driving the nonprofit's three mobile classrooms that once were recreational vehicles, and delivering food and supplies to the program sites. They also sort and distribute the 33,000 books Read and Feed gives to kids each year, as well as helping to run the organization and raising money. In the school year just ended, Read and Feed volunteers drove a total of 8,250 miles. This past school year, Read and Feed served 10 sites with its mobile classrooms and another 8 sites in facilities of partner organizations. Each mobile classroom offers 2 one-hour sessions each evening for 12 children per session, and each facility-based program offers weekly sessions lasting an hour to 75 minutes for about 24 children. At each session, children get a meal, then spend about 35 minutes listening to stories read by volunteer tutors, who also provide help with reading and spelling and reading aloud. According to a survey of their public school teachers, 88% of students who participate in Read and Feed have increased their reading skills and confidence, Mullen says. Read and Feed counts on contributions to operate, as well as 2 fundraising events each fall that last year netted a total of $47,000, and this year aims to raise $70,000. In 2011, the nonprofit operated at 7 sites and had just purchased its second van. In 2014, it was operating at 17 sites and purchased its third van. Now, Read and Feed is considering expanding more, possibly to other counties. Our program is so much more than a reading program or a reading comprehension program, says Mullen. It's a nurturing and mentoring program. And in nonprofit news, Golf charity raises money for veterans. Some 268 golfers participated in the 5th annual EDM4US Troops Golf Tournament held June 6 at Prestonwood Country Club in Cary. The tournament raised over $140,000 for local U.S. troops and their families. Donation spurs new features at Marbles. Thanks to a donation from MetLife, Marbles Kids Museum opened Step Notes, an imaginative musical experience. Marbles has transformed an ordinary staircase into a playful piano with interactive, colorful lights. And now we turn to the Viewpoint page in the Triangle Business Journal. And first we turn to a column written by Dr. Tashni Dubrow, who is president of Shaw University, and Matt Wolf, who is the athletics development officer of the university. The headline on their column, Why Shaw University's Future Should Matter to All of Us. Shaw University is the oldest historically black university in the southern United States, located in downtown Raleigh. Founded in 1865 by Dr. Henry Martin Tupper to educate freed slaves, the university recently celebrated 150 years of educational excellence in 2015. We recently announced that the university has seen a record number of applications for admission to the institution during the fall 2016 recruitment season. This statistic represents a welcome change to the declining enrollment numbers now being experienced by universities all across the country. Latest tallies from the Office of Enrollment Management show new freshman applications up by 74% over last year and a 145% increase in the number of confirmed new students in the previous year. Shaw also anticipates about a 10% increase in new international students as the institution has beefed up recruitment activities abroad. Many students, from academic to athletic, have benefited from the financial support of donors. We rely heavily on individuals and businesses investing as we continue to excel here at Shaw University, but we need adequate financial resources. Over the years, this community has greatly benefited from our student graduates who have gone on to work at local companies, nonprofits, and participated in policymaking to move North Carolina forward in economic terms. More than ever, diversity matters, and the management and administration at Shaw are acutely aware of it as we participate in weaving the multicultural fabric of this community. If the corporate triangle is in agreement with our mission and goal, this is the time to show that support. As we successfully conclude another academic year, the demand for Shaw education is as important as it was when we opened our doors more than 150 years ago. We have raised more than $3 million in private support this year, a 40% increase from our previous year. However, we need $400,000 to meet this year's goal. To help us reach our goal, we have received a generous challenge from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation. This challenge is a testament to the support Shaw University is garnering from our community partners. The grant offers a match for new or increased giving to Shaw University. For example, you give to the university for the first time or make a gift after a 3-year lapse in giving, your gift totals $1,000. Your entire gift amount will qualify for the match. You give $500 to Shaw University during 2014-2015, and this year you give $750 in response to the challenge. $250, the increase between last year and this year's gift, will qualify for the match. If we are to continue to serve the people of this region, our remarkable growth in enrollment, projected to be 2,000 by the year 2020, must be matched by enhanced faculty recruitment, academic programs, and infrastructure development. We must begin preparing for the future now. Your donation will make a difference. We have just a few days left in this campaign, June 30th, and for the community's sake, we are determined to reach our goal. Given our structure and our lofty goals, new investments are needed as we continue to be EPIC, their campaign slogan, here at Shaw University. Epic. Give because it will make you happier. Give because you think the organization is making a difference, and give because every bit helps. And also on the Viewpoint page, we have the Editor's Notebook written by Sugata Mukherjee, who is editor of the Triangle Business Journal. The headline, Microsoft's LinkedIn buy reflects disruptive climate. When the news broke June 13 that Microsoft is buying LinkedIn for $26.2 billion, almost everyone who knows anything about those two companies must have had a collective, huh? After all, Microsoft makes software tools absolutely nothing in common with what LinkedIn does, which is a social networking site for people in business. Satya Nadella, Microsoft's chief executive, essentially bet the future of his company with this deal. Without a doubt, this is the first step, a $26 billion step, that will go into the remake of tomorrow's Microsoft. And computer software, it ain't. I would have loved to hear Bill Gates' initial reaction when he was told, "Hey Bill, tomorrow we are calling Jeff Weiner, LinkedIn CEO, and telling him we want to buy you. Good idea, no?" But you start thinking a little more about the deal and perhaps it starts to make more sense. The only thing common among the two companies is the customer demographic. They are business people and they are professionals. So perhaps this is where the technology meets the people under one roof. LinkedIn has lots of people on its platform, somewhere in the 405 million range, with more than $100 billion in cash and cash equivalents. This is Microsoft's biggest bet to stay relevant. But isn't relevance the key element to success in this disruptive environment? Think about any industry. If companies, especially small and mid-sized regional firms, think they can grow doing the same thing over and over again, they will be the first to go. Relevance is forcing change everywhere. If Microsoft thought the writing was on the wall, so should everyone. Think of the media. Look how we went from one-dimensional delivery mechanism to a system that shares, likes, promotes, and suggests stories. That doesn't mean that's all we do. Journalism must still be the forefront. But we now know our readers much better than we did 10 years ago. The LinkedIn buy teaches us that all CEOs must forecast the needs and wants for their products and services down the line. Microsoft knew the traditional ways of selling PC software simply wouldn't be enough. It needed direct access to people making those purchasing decisions in millions and fast. Now the company can start thinking of creating deeper relationships thanks to LinkedIn's database. No one can predict whether this will be a colossal waste of money for Microsoft and the biggest legal heist for Weiner and Reid Hoffman, LinkedIn's executive chairman. We'll know that in just a few years. But the road to success starts with acceptance, not denial. Microsoft accepted its inevitable future and did not like what it saw, so it's changing the trajectory. And now we turn to the People on the Move page in the Triangle Business Journal. And the spotlight is on Jessica Mitch, Executive Director of the Code School at the Iron Yard. Since joining the Iron Yard in Durham a few years ago, Jessica Mitch has quickly been moving up the ranks. After honing her tech and people skills at Red Hat, she joined the Iron Yard in 2014 as the founding campus director of the Durham campus. Mitch went on to lead the Iron Yard's campus operations team as director of global campus operations and worked to grow the Code School's global footprint. Now she's the executive director of its Code School. The Iron Yard bills itself as an immersive code school that exists to provide technology education. Full-time courses are offered in a number of tech disciplines, including back-end and front-end engineering, mobile engineering, and design. In her new role, Mitch is responsible for building and growing the Code School's national partnerships, increasing diversity and inclusion efforts, and supporting its expanding alumni network. The organization has now expanded to 22 campuses across the U.S. The need arose for dedicated oversight to our national relationships and initiatives, and for someone to drive and define success in the markets we are growing in, Mitch says of her new role. What's one thing you wish people knew about your job? How much fun it is. The job is a lot of hard work, but is tremendously rewarding. I've had the great privilege to experience firsthand the opportunity that exists for both EdTech and the tech industry at large. I believe that many people are stuck in the "what do I want to do" career question. People seek work that's meaningful, fun, creative, and allows them to work with amazing people. I've known that exists, and at the Iron Yard, we were working hard to help people see what's possible with a career in tech. What are some of your major goals for your new position? The most important overarching objective that will guide both my goals for this role and the company's direction for the next few years is ensuring that we are having a positive impact on the people and communities we serve. This means maintaining a positive culture for our staff, ensuring that our students have the tools to succeed, and that we teach to the industry's needs. It also means staying highly conscious and aware of creating a diverse workforce and being a welcoming place for all learners. Biggest pet peeve? Texting while driving. Don't do it. Triangle area business person you most admire? My parents, DJ and Barry Mitch, owners of the Pyramid Resource Group. They built their own business that gave them the lifestyle to support me and my brother. Last book you've read? Originals, How Nonconformists Move the World by Adam Grant. Now we turn to the Washington Watch and the Triangle Business Journal with an article by Kent Hoover. The headline, Changing the Troubling Narrative. TSA praised for responding with solutions to fix long airport security lines. What a difference a month makes. In May, Peter Neffinger, head of the Transportation Security Agency, was on the hot seat at a House hearing on airport security after 500 people were stranded at Chicago's O'Hare International Airport when they missed their flights due to long security lines. On June 7, Neffinger was praised for his management skills at a Senate hearing after travelers experienced few problems at airports during the busy Memorial Day weekend. TSA screened 10.3 million passengers during this holiday period, and more than 90% of them spent less than 15 minutes in security lines, Neffinger said. Besides replacing its management team at O'Hare, TSA has responded to long airport lines by adding more security officers, particularly at the nation's busiest airports, which enabled it to open more lanes there. The agency established a National Incident Command Center so it can track daily screening operations and redeploy resources when passenger surges are expected. You have to be laser-focused on the actual operations, airport by airport at the largest airports, says Neffinger, a former Coast Guard Vice Admiral who was confirmed by the Senate nearly a year ago to fix the TSA's problems. If you improve security operations at the nation's top 20 airports, you can really, for the most part, solve the problems for the whole system, he said. Congress has helped TSA address its problems, including investigations that showed that banned items were routinely getting through security checkpoints. By reprogramming money so that TSA could hire more airport security officers. But members of the Senate and TSA watchdogs praised Neffinger for tackling the agency's shortcomings instead of trying to make excuses for them. I believe we are in a different place than we were last June, said John Roth, Inspector General for the Department of Homeland Security. TSA is now, for the first time in memory, critically assessing its deficiencies in an honest and objective light. TSA's leadership has embraced the OIG's oversight role and appears to be addressing vulnerabilities. You're doing a great job of looking at this honestly, said Senator Ron Johnson, Republican Wisconsin, told Neffinger. It's going to take some time to correct all the TSA's problems, Neffinger said. Working with the private sector is where I see the greatest promise going forward, he told senators. For example, thanks to Delta Airlines, two new automated security lanes recently went into operation at Hartsfield-Jackson Atlanta International Airport, which has dramatically sped up the processing of passengers. Other airport security innovations will be tested at other airports. The TSA also is open to letting more airports contract out their security checkpoints to private businesses instead of using agency personnel. But Neffinger said there's no difference in wait times between comparable airports staffed by contractors and those staffed by the TSA. And with our remaining minutes, we'll read as much as we can from the small business column written by Edward Marshall, who is an adjunct professor at the Fuqua School of Business at Duke University and managing partner of the Marshall Group, LLC. The headline on his column, Build Workplace Culture Through Trust and Collaboration. The senior leadership of a major department of a very well-known company found itself in a quandary. Half of the group who had been at the company for at least 15 years felt the culture was fine. The newbies of 3 years or less, including the new leader, felt that the culture needed to change, given negative feedback. Customers were unhappy and considering outsourcing their service. An engagement survey found wide discontent. Response times were down, priorities were not being met, and internal differences were turned into grudges. So the leader implemented a well-respected cultural assessment. The results were not good. They found they had a predominantly passive-aggressive culture that pitted people against each other and where problems were avoided, denied, or deflected. On the other hand, there was violent agreement on the collaborative culture they wanted. The newbies wanted change. The tenured members did not. They were, in effect, independent contractors rather than team players. Their motto about change was, "Not in my backyard." The schism between the two groups erupted when the assessment results were presented. There was a virtual cultural meltdown as the more tenured members blamed the C-suite and accused their leader of threatening them by talking about outsourcing. Some challenged the validity of the assessment. There was full-on avoidance, denial, and deflection behavior. This group will not succeed long-term. Millennials will leave. Customers will outsource their services. Confidence will be lost. The new leader will move on. This kind of behavior is common, though often hidden behind the facade of nice and kind, but not honest. Studies show most companies have passive or aggressive defensive cultures where fear prevails, you don't speak truth to power, and hierarchy and politics are how things get done. Toxic cultural meltdowns can be avoided by building on these critical success factors: progressive leadership, a trusting and safe space, a team that cares, a willingness to look and engage, and a commitment to act. And we'll have to stop there, actually, as we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. But be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. The program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. You can contact us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.